Well, hi there, I'm Jonathan Doyle, and it's my great pleasure to share with you personally this message that I recently gave at a large men's breakfast. It was a real privilege to speak about issues of masculinity and identity because they're big issues in our lives, personally, and in our whole culture. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. I hope you really do get something out of the important principles you're about to hear. I'm going to press right in. I'm running a recording of this for you today, which I'll have on the internet for you by Monday. So you'll get a lot of great stuff. You can listen to it again and again. But we only have 5 hours together now, so I really want to get started and get you home sometime after lunch. Now, let's begin. This concept of identity, we should have a, hopefully, I'll just bring up an image for you here. But if you think about this concept of identity, it's not something you think about a great deal. Think about the things you discuss regularly with other men. You might discuss footy, you might discuss politics, you might discuss work, but identity, masculine identity, doesn't tend to be one of those things that you discuss very frequently. You don't see a bunch of guys sitting around a pub going, you know, Dave-O, I've just got these deep existential concerns about my sense of masculine identity. And his mate's like, going, Smitty, I know. Do we have a deep ontological core, or are we just, you know, actors in this existential drama seeking to find some sense of core? Doesn't happen a lot in any pubs that you will have been to. Excuse the assistant as I get this organized. Hang on, 2 seconds, mate. I'll just bring that back up. So if you'll indulge me for 2 seconds, as technology does what it does so frequently, this concept of identity is not something we think about, but what I want to prove very quickly is how utterly central this idea of identity actually is to you personally and culturally. I'll give you a couple of examples. Think about the German people in the late 1920s and early 1930s. Their experience of the First World War, the Treaty of Versailles, economic conditions at that particular time, their sense of identity was in a very particular place. And that sense of identity was very much impacted by another person who you'd be very familiar with. So this core issue of identity, what I'm going to argue is that it is the central issue in your life and in culture in general. I think it's the core issue, and it's actually the core issue that the Catholic Church is involved in globally. The question is simply this: what does it mean to be a person? What does it mean to be a person? And you're sitting there now thinking, Saturday morning, man, what does it matter? It matters a great deal. I want to show you what it looks like in practice. If you have a look at this, next image here, this is the gas ovens at Auschwitz. 6 million people up a smokestack. Your teeth fillings these days are done with amalgam. In the 1940s, they were done with solid gold. You'd be forced to open your mouth and your teeth would be ripped out with pliers. You do that to 6 million people, you get a large amount of gold. You're stuck in a room about this size, 500 naked people, women, children, two-year-olds. I got, you know what, 3 kids under 5. You see mothers holding little children as they drop chemical pellets of Zyklonol B through the ceiling, gas them 500 at a time, drag the bodies out, put them on little rail cars, and keep them, put them into the gas ovens there, which are kept burning hot enough to burn human bone. 6 million people up a smokestack. Question, how is it possible? It's the problem, friends, is that it's incredibly easy to do it. You know what you do? You just cross a line in your mind that's this big. You just go, that's a person. That's not. That's a person. That's not. Cross a line in your mind. It's not a real line, is it? It's just a line in your head this big. 6 million people up a smokestack. Identity central. What you think a person is will affect you. It'll affect culture. Every question we have, politics, economics, life issues, is all about identity. The other example, a face you'll be very familiar with. At the age of 34, she's on a train across India. She's a teacher. She's working with the Loreto sisters. She believes God speaks to her. She goes and rents a tiny little room in the side of a Hindu temple. She goes out the next morning. She does 2 things. She only ever did 2 things. People go, she's so famous. She did all this stuff. No, it was actually a lot of businessmen. Some very senior US businessmen got behind her vision and helped her grow it. She was famous because she kept doing exactly the same two things. Number one, she went out the first day, she found this person sitting in the gutter. The only way you can be found sitting in a gutter in Calcutta, India is a very familial-oriented society, is probably mental retardation. Because that's one of the few ways that your family would completely reject you. Picture this person sitting in the gutter. They obviously have some kind of disease. They're filthy. She takes them to the side room of the Hindu temple. She does thing number one. She washes their body. 6 million people up a smokestack, one person having their body washed by a complete stranger. Then she does thing number two. In her journal, she says, I held their hands. I looked into their eyes. And I smiled as they died. Because I wanted the last thing that they see on this planet to be a face of love. 6 million people up a smokestack. One person loved to the point of death by a complete stranger. What is the difference? It's incredibly simple. What you think a person is. What you think you are. Powerful. We never think about it. Isn't it? Can you see the what we call a disjunct here? Something so central to your existence that you essentially never think about. Think about the power of getting identity wrong. What if you're living in a way that's not what you actually are? What if a pedophile thinks he's a priest? Vast numbers of men will go to their graves having completely lived the wrong life. The stakes are very high. St. Augustine famously said, he who made you without your cooperation will not save you without your cooperation. God will completely give you the freedom to ruin your life. So, getting identity wrong, crucial. Here in this city yesterday, in our major paper here, one writer was talking about workplace deaths. And her theory was that what's driving a lot of it is a desire for men to prove themselves. They don't want to do particularly safe things because it's just seen as not something you want to do. Why would you want to prove yourself? Because you're not sure who you are. So you fall five stories and die. So switching gears now to this concept of masculinity, identity and masculinity. When I did my first master's degree in leadership and management, what struck me after the years of study was that the concept of leadership, there is no consensus. All over the world, vastly different theories from experts in every field about what leadership actually is. And masculinity is actually the same. You won't find consensus on what it means to be a man, the core essence of masculinity. We can have feminist critiques, post-feminist critiques, Marxist critiques, postmodern critiques. There's no consensus on what it actually means to be male. And what I want to do leading into this is say, please remember this, our culture has absolutely no idea what the hell to do with manhood at all. Do we need it? It's ridiculed. I mean, often you've heard about the TV commercials, right? Men are stupid. Men are always dumb. The intelligent woman comes and helps the stupid man. Flip it the other way, friends, and the outcry would be extraordinary. The culture has no idea what to do with men. But we're fine to send huge numbers of Hispanics in the US to go and get blown to pieces by IEDs around the world. Many useful, you know, in the US Marines in different places, but you sort of go, well, they're really useful here, but we don't need them anywhere else. And at a men's conference recently, I just threw up some images of what of our cultural problem with manhood. Look at some of these images on the question of what does it mean to be a man or a fine man. Very confused, isn't it? It's really confused. But we have some good news. That's some really good news for you. I'm going to actually argue that there's some core things. So very simply, I'll push through this now. The basic argument is what we call a social constructivist theory. Is manhood and masculinity socially constructed? It's just a whole bunch of roles that are placed on you throughout history. Or is there what we call an ontological core? Ontology is just the study of essence, of being, of what something is. So is there a fixed core? Is there something very definitive about being male? Yes, absolutely I believe there is. Strangely today, I'm not actually going to spend a huge amount of time focused on it. But for those of you that have had any background in it, Trinitarian anthropology tells us that the making of a gift of oneself in love, the generative male essence in the service of something bigger than itself is the core ontological attribute of manhood. Let's move on from that. It's a story for another day. So is it constructed or is it fixed? And the last thing before I'm going to actually ask you to do something with me is just to realize the sheer size of the seismic changes in manhood over the last, say, 500 years. Think pre-industrial revolution, mostly agrarian societies. Your dad grew flax. Guess what you did? You grew flax. But you were next to him every day. From the minute you were physically capable of work, you were with him every day. The smell of your father. If I say that to you now, all of you can remember that smell. No matter if you're 80. When my father died recently, one of the last things I had was the clothes that came home from hospital. And for months afterwards, Robert Bly used to say that sons lived in close proximity to their fathers, sometimes murderously close. Industrial Revolution, massive change. Men uprooted from this close connection with the father, massive social dislocation. Factory work, our school system began to emerge, boys separated from fathers. Would we go back to an agrarian society? No, but we've got to recognize there's been some big change. In 1910, the divorce rate was 9%. In 1910, the divorce rate was 9%. It's currently around 42 to 47. Half our boys won't have a father in the home. Judge no one. I don't know anybody in the room's background. But, David Blenkinhorn's famous book, Fatherless America. Half our boys, where will they learn to be men? Where will they learn the basics, manhood 101? It was interesting listening to President Obama give a speech to his campaign workers a day or 36 hours after the election. And I noticed something interesting he said. He said, talked about his advocacy work with inner city black people in Chicago. And I heard him on the radio say, "That's where I became a man." Wrong. You don't become a man by anything you do. Well, manhood is conferred. And that'll make sense as we go. After years of work, second master's degree, working with hundreds of thousands of men, a boy becomes a man when his father or the community of men tell him he is and recognize it in important symbolic ways. You can't do anything. Oh, I got married and I'm committed to my children. I work hard. But there's a chasm inside of you the size of Texas. So here's a question, just to break this up a little bit. You're all sitting there going, "Where did they find him? Jonathan, we're the good guys, man." Or we're going to make the good guys better. I want to ask you a question. Like a couple of people in this room that I, I'm a control freak. Massive control freak. Someone just goes, "No." I had 160 flights on Qantas last year, and I don't like flying. Why? Because this thing would all work better if I got to drive the damn thing. That's like that Simpsons episode when Homer wants to deliver the baby and the doctor says, "Maybe it's better if I do it." And Homer's like, "What are you, college boy?" I want to go up the front and fly the thing. But my control freak tendencies are interesting. Why? Because the more speaking that I do here and overseas, because of the amount of speaking bubble, I get to control how it happens, how the room's set, what I need to have. Because I want to do it well and I need certain things to happen. But it was interesting that I had no control at all over this topic. None. Nothing. Just Joseph said, "That's your topic." I find that really interesting. Because when that happens and my control strategies get broken, God's usually going to do something pretty cool. And I get out of the way. Now, here's the question. The topic was reclaiming masculinity. I didn't choose that topic. We only reclaim what is either lost or stolen. Qantas used to lose my bag once a week. Mr. Doyle, we don't want you to get bored. We want excitement in your life. Guess where it's gone today? Have you heard of Sierra Leone, Mr. Doyle? No. But reclaiming also means a sense of loss, doesn't it? A sense of loss. Something's been lost. So I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to do it two ways. I'm going to ask you the question. I'm going to ask you to think about it quietly in your own, in the privacy of your own mind for about 15 seconds. I'm going to ask you then just to discuss it. I'm going to put some music on. I want you to ask you to discuss it with the man next to you just for a couple of seconds. I want to throw him up here, then I've got to move on because I've got a bucket of great stuff to do with you. Here's your question. What do you think has caused a sense of male identity to be lost? What do you think has caused a sense of male identity to be lost? Think about that now. What has caused a sense of male identity to be lost? If you'd indulge me, 30 seconds, just with a guy next to you, on that question, what do you think has caused a sense of identity to be lost? Okay, friends, thank you for that. That's useful for me to steal your ideas and write a book. That's useful for me to hear your input on important topics. Here's what we want to do. Here's what we want to do. I've suggested that, what have I done so far? Massive cultural change. Identity is central and crucial. What are we going to do with the identity question as men? I'm going to give you two options, and then I'm going to suggest a third that might work. The first two don't work, but they're the ones that probably most of you in this room have been running most of your life. Option one, in terms of this sense of identity, is that we will construct an identity to meet some sense of external approval. Men, the other one, I'm going to break these open, but the second one is that we're going to protect the self with what we call defensive behaviors. And defensive behaviors are going to look like mental illness. Depression, anxiety, and a whole bunch of people in the room going, ooh. Well, a lot of what I'm doing these days is taking a lot of sacred cows out the back and slowly sending them to a better place. I'm going to stand on some very good research. Massive global pharmacological companies have a huge interest in convincing us of certain things, but I want to give you another insight into the depression thing. I'm going to suggest is that when men discover that life or certain things are way too hard and they can't compete or that they will withdraw into different behaviors, and we'll break that open. Firstly, construct an identity. Here's my principle. Men run scoreboards. Men run scoreboards. I ran scoreboards for 37 years. I stopped last year. I remember speaking at an elite private school in this country, 500 parents. Lady comes to me at the end, four boys under 12. Stunning looking woman. And she just starts to cry. Marriage is under pressure. Dad's home 6 months of the year. Major job in international, I won't even say the career, but very wealthy. And I'm thinking, what could compel a man? What stories is he telling himself? It is more important for me to generate this amount of revenue than to be a father at this crucial time to these boys and to man up to the promises I made to be a husband to my wife. What force would be strong enough to compel a man to do that? Now, I have run the most of my life. From the youngest age, for complex reasons of my own background. I remember being, in my final years of high school, being so utterly obsessed with playing footy. And I was good, and the guy ahead of me was a state rep, but my entire existence was externalized into that identity. And people go, well, it's good to be competitive. And yes, it is. But the question is, what's the core drive? I also make the point that one thing that I struggle with in the life of the Catholic Church is that it has no idea what to do with men and businessmen at all. No idea what to do with wealth. One speaker once said, the best thing you can do to help the poor is not be one of them. Sounds terrible, doesn't it? But out of your abundance, some men are called to business. You can impact situations and you can serve people with resource and finance. So friends, those of you in the room who have been successful in business or life, do not hear for a second I'm saying you should be apologetic. The question is, what's the core drive? So money and success is basically the cultural paradigm. How do you prove to us that you're an extraordinary man? What you drive, what you wear, what you own, what you've built. So quickly, the cultural idea is what we call self-actualization. Abraham Maslow, what do? You take your talents and your abilities and you push them to the highest level and you get success and wealth by becoming the fullness of what these talents could be. You drive it to the highest level. Thomas Merton in his book, The Seven Story Mountain, said, listen to this, try and remember these words, it'll be on the tape. He said, the purpose of life is not self-actualization. The purpose of life is to fully recollect yourself so you can fully give. To fully know who you are, and out of that knowledge to give of yourself to business, to marriage, to life, to community service, to priesthood. But can you see the water we're swimming in? Who do we culturally validate in our media and marketing? The construction of identity, a couple of last things. The irony is extraordinary. Andre Agassi, I just read his biography. It's a great biography. You find out at the very end that he didn't write it. But then I bought the books of all the guy that did write it. It's very good. I don't know, who's read it? Okay. You've got fantastic book, great read. Here's the amazing thing, and this will blow your mind if you don't know this. The great secret of Andre Agassi is what? He hates tennis. He makes the point so many times in the book, I hate tennis. From the first game as a child to the last US Open, he hates tennis. And he just documents it all the time. He said it'd be funny, he'd meet people. And they go, wow, you know, what a life, you're traveling, you're so passionate about the game. He goes, no, it's funny, really, actually, I hate tennis. And they're like, oh, that's really fun. No, I'm dead serious, I hate tennis. And you know, his father was, I think, came from a sort of Middle Eastern background and drove him relentlessly. And his father built this massive tennis ball machine and he juiced it up, built a bigger diesel engine on it. And here's this four-year-old boy with his boo, 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 boo. And he's there at four just going bang, bang, bang. My father is shooting me hundreds of times a day. But this identity emerged out of this deeply broken, hurt place. Tiger Woods. Friends, the only way you have sex with over 100 women is you're a sex addict. And the only way you have become a sex addict is if you have profound pain and a massive need for validation. Who am I, Dad? Who am I, Dad, if I'm not this? What am I? Finally, this occurred to me. I've really enjoyed putting this talk together because so many great insights have come this week. I had another big one, which is simply this. Think of the energy that some of us, and I don't know you all, and some of you will be like, no, dude, I'm not like this. I'm looking culturally across a whole group of men. Whatever you construct as an identity, death is going to obliterate it. It's comical irony. I just read Steve Jobs' biography. And you build and you build and you build and you build, and this is often in the Old Testament, isn't it? Death's going to strip it. And some people go, well, I leave a legacy and it'll help people. Correct. But let's not take our identities too seriously. Here's an insight for you. Anybody know who the richest person in global history has been over the entire history of human existence, back to the pharaohs, everybody? This person is so far beyond any competitor, it's mind-blowing. His wealth was so utterly extraordinary. Anybody want to take a guess who it was? No, not even ballpark. No, much more recent. J.D. Rockefeller, his wealth is seismically in comparison beyond anybody else's. Here's a question for you. When he died, does anybody know how much of his personal fortune he left? How much he left behind when he died? All of it. He was dead. It's interesting, isn't it? It's just the death, the great leveler that we build and we build and we build. And I'm not saying don't build because I'm building here, passionate about this stuff. Okay, so we've looked a little bit at the construct an identity thing and we have to own that and go, where's it come from in me? And the second one is, of course, the second option is the defensive behaviours. Now, I want to stand here on the ground of Dorothy Rowe, who's one of the best, most famous writers. She's in her 80s now. Clinical psychologist, has written for decades on mental health. And she says some very contentious things. And I want to begin this by saying that the global pharmaceutical industry has a huge interest in getting us all to believe certain things. Chemical imbalance in the brain. Except there really isn't much evidence for it. She argues two things. Depression, we're going to talk about mostly. Why? Because there will be men sitting in this room right now who wrestle with depression. As I did for 10 years. You know, diagnosed by one of the best clinical psychologists with full-blown clinical depression. And when I read the reports, I was just like, no. No one ever knew. Why? Because I was out there performing all around the world. You're one of the first audiences to begin to see me post-performing era. So I'm going to stand on a personal experience and on her words. Depression, she says, is the difference. Please listen to this. Get the tape. Listen to it again. The difference between what we thought our life was and what it actually is. And probably our inability to turn and face the truth of that. So she sees depression as a defensive behavior. We can't turn and face the truth of the difference between the life we thought we really lived and the one that we really do live. And the second thing, beautifully, she says is this. This is very powerful for some of us in the room. She makes the point repeatedly that we stay in the prison of depression until we get the message that it is trying to teach us. The message is that the way we have been living is flawed. I spent 10 years around the world. A lot of it was good, coming from a good place, but just wiping myself out and slowly starting to go, why am I doing this? Who am I really? C.S. Lewis famously said, it's a beautiful line, the great irony of hell is that the gates are wide open. And depression as a defensive behavior, if we can't compete in this great big cultural idea of success and perfection and strength and conquering, that some of us will just pull back into that. So friends, they're the two things that aren't going to work. So I thought what we might do is talk a little bit about what actually will. But again, if you'll indulge me for a moment, I have been a male for my entire life. And I have no intention for that to change. What I do know is that testosterone peaks in the human male at about 16. It plateaus till about 32, then it begins a slow decline. Slow decline. One of the things testosterone does is it makes you need to move. So I'm going to have a drink of water. Let's take 30 seconds, stand where you are, have a stretch if you need to, and we'll start again in 30 seconds. Well, hi again, Jonathan Doyle here. Everybody in the room got a stretch at this point, and it might be worthwhile just taking a break for a moment yourself. There's a lot of big stuff here and some great stuff still to come in part two. So take a break, walk around the room, maybe grab yourself a pen and paper to take some notes on the important principles about to come up in part two.